Miss Ruth was tall, stately, flowing white hair, and she was always dressed impeccably. Or at least that's the way I remember her. She was a retired first through second grade teacher in the small, all 12 grades in one building school where I graduated high school. I had not known her as a teacher. My mother and I had moved back to the small town where my mother grew up after my parents split, and Miss Ruth had retired long before I began school there as a socially awkward ninth grader with teeth that were a mess and glasses that most resembled the bottom of Coke bottles. But Miss Ruth was to be, unbeknownst to her or to me that time, a strong influence on what religion is and what religion means to me right up to today. One of Miss Ruth's long-standing commitments was to the choir of the small Presbyterian church in the town where I lived. The kids I hung with in school, like me, children of the old farming families, who most of whom had arrived there a generation or sometimes two before, from England, Scotland, and Ireland, attended that little church on the corner. And I did as well. It was what we did. It was just part of being there. I should note, it was Miss Ruth who invited me to join the choir. Now, I should note that as a high school student, my voice was quite a better shape than it is now, so that wasn't as outlandish a prospect as it may seem before Jim gets up and runs away in terror. I liked to sing, and I had developed a love for church music, especially the old classical hymns that Presbyterians favored. So that was a big deal. I was thrilled. When I look back on it, it was about a lot more than the music, and it was really more about other things than it was about the music. Miss Ruth had invited me into community, into being a part of that church community and of the smaller, more closely knit community that was the choir to which she was so committed. That was to be the first of a number of things that would shape how I experienced religion. Right up to this morning, religion for me continues to be hugely about community. And I've experienced that sense of community in every religious group I've ever been involved in. I was an undergraduate at Ohio State University. That would be the Ohio State University. The community church I attended there, and especially the campus ecumenical student fellowship, provided face-to-face contact, and they were a workable size for a thoroughly lost freshman. There were 28 in my graduating class from high school. I think the first year I was at Ohio State, there were 48,000 of us. What do you do with that? I was utterly, utterly befuddled. From Ohio State, I went to a small Methodist seminary just north of Columbus, Ohio. 150, 200 students or so at that time. It's much bigger now. But we knew every other student, even those of us who, like myself, were commuters. We basically knew everybody. And we knew our professors as human beings, not as the demigods that they had appeared at Ohio State. Well, from there it was off to graduate school at Vanderbilt University, and a couple of you who have Nashville and Vanderbilt roots may know this church. Presbyterian congregation out on, I think it was 21st Trinity Presbyterian Church. It was a large congregation, but nevertheless, I soon found my tribe among other parents of kids about my daughter's age and who shared my interest in hiking, camping, and potlucks. There was also quite a bit of overlap between the Vanderbilt religion faculty and Trinity people. Well, I moved here and I didn't find the Protestant liberalism that I had expected among denominations that I'd been associated with in Ohio and at Vanderbilt. Based on what I knew from that time in history and what I'd experienced, I was expecting a great deal of social and theological liberalism, which I didn't find, but I did find this place, thanks in large measure to, some of you will know this name, David Morris, a retired sociologist from Ball State whose office was up the hall from mine. Well, so I found this place, later moved to rather far east of Columbus, although I was still at Ball State, helped to found the East Central Indiana Mindfulness Sangha. After that folded, I joined the ranks of the unchurched, or as we call them in sociology, for many years, many years. And I found my way back here in 2001, when I returned to Muncie from Randolph County. I have found and am deeply grateful for the welcoming community that I have found in each of these places. Community which for me is as essential as breathing. I have also, on further reflection, been both inside and outside, in all of them, without exception. I've never found the perfect place. I might have been aware of that even as early as high school, but I had not had the benefit of our coming-of-age program to get me thinking theologically, and so I wasn't. That's really the point of this reflection on my personal journey among faith communities. Many of us have arrived here after similar journeys or journeys that were even more circuitous and winding. Perhaps we felt like we had come home at last, that we had stumbled across that place where we truly belong, that we had found our utopia. First coined by Sir Thomas More in the title of his 1516 book, Utopia, the word comes from a couple of Greek words that taken together literally mean no place, utopos. In conventional usage, though, it's come to mean a society that is seen as being ideal or without fault. But note, this describes a non-existent place or society, like More's fictional island in the Atlantic. Put simply, there is no utopia. No community will be 100% of what we want it to be, even leaving aside the question of whether what we want it to be is what we need it to be. We need challenge as well as support if we are to grow and thrive, and challenge can be disturbing. Some religious groups are held together by well-defined answers to life's big questions. Eternal salvation through Jesus as Christ for traditional Christians, or the absolute uncompromising commitment to the oneness and singularity of God among Jews and Muslims, for example. Others, such as Catholic and Episcopalian Christians, share a common way of worship. Still others, as the Presbyterianism of my early years, are defined by a specific form of church government. It's government by presbyters or elders. Well, we on the other hand tend to prefer questions to solid answers. and seeking to finding. You'll find widely varied styles of worship encompassed within our UU tradition. And although we do share a commitment to a form of church government that blends denominational cooperation with congregational independence, I doubt most of us would tend to say that that defines us. So what does keep this wildly diverse and sometimes unruly group together? What resources do we have for staying at the table, staying present physically, mentally, emotionally, and in the discussion when we disagree, as we inevitably will? For many of us, we have found here a sense of community, a common bond of commitment to principles and ideals. We have found a community we want to be a part of. We have found support in good times and in bad. We have found, in a word with a long and honorable history in religious and spiritual life, fellowship. And that's why it hurts when diversity crosses the line into divisiveness. We can't just walk away, nor do we want to. But sometimes we also feel we can't stay. How can we leverage what we have to allow us to remain in the conversation when we disagree? How do we continue to affirm our faith in each other and in the strength of the ties that join us, each to each and each to all? Came across a wonderful invented word recently. It was used to describe a person, but it can also, I think, apply to communities. It's flawsome, F-L-A-W-S-O-M-E, a combination of flawed and awesome. Which raises the question, how do we affirm the awesome in the face of the flawed? When we ask ourselves what drew us here to this place in the first place, my hunch is that for many of us it had to do with community and with the belief that this is a community that can accommodate a diversity of viewpoints and negotiate differences, that it is a community where diversity of opinion, of ideas, of lifestyle, of hopes and dreams for our community itself is recognized, not only accepted, but celebrated. Well, how can we make all that real here and now? How do we remain committed to seeking truth and meaning in community, even though in the end, we're all responsible for our own answers? Staying at the table doesn't mean we will necessarily agree. We may disagree absolutely, and we may express our disagreement forcefully. Some of the times, as in families, we will agree. Other times, we will not see eye to eye at all, just like the two brothers in our story for all ages. Staying at the table does mean we affirm our commitment to this community in its wholeness and its brokenness. When we agree and when we do not, it calls on us to be willing to participate in the change process and risk being changed by it, because that's what full participation means. We ourselves may be changed by the shared dialogue. Would be a good example of this a couple of weekends from now at the congregational meeting, when, among other things, we'll be discussing the possibility of moving to two services. If we are to do this, if we are to maintain trust and faith with the community, even in questioning, even when we're hurting, we need to be able to affirm deep in our bones the truth of Thomas Merton's assertion that our true destiny is love, we do not find the meaning of life by ourselves. We find it with another. We can affirm our third principle of acceptance of each other and spiritual growth, even when the growing we're doing at a particular time may make it seem as though we're awkward, gangly teenagers or small puppies falling all over their own feet. We work on our rough edges together. All of this, I think, brings our October theme of humility full circle, because it relates very directly to what Reverend Seth said in his first sermon this month. Humility, he pointed out, means that we go into any discussion with the intention of being open, with an attitude of friendly curiosity, with the assumption that we can learn from those with whom we disagree. We enter into discussion and even into conflict with that same intention to remain open, to remain teachable, to remain willing to learn, curious about what matters and why it does to those with whom we disagree. Beyond this, it seems to me that humility means knowing and accepting and celebrating and embracing the idea that mine is not the only point of view, and being willing not only to allow or tolerate other views, practices, and lifestyles, but to actively encourage and enable the diversity among us. We can and must be agreeable without being. Let's just try that sentence again. We can disagree without being disagreeable. In conclusion, we have a community here that is alive, vibrant, welcoming, and capable of sustaining and supporting us along our life's journeys. Our community can and will continue to exist in the presence of difference and disagreement. We can stay at the table, can remain fully present and engaged, even when we disagree, even when we feel fearful and anxious, because change seems to be swirling around us. Humility enables us to accept, to welcome, and to celebrate our differences. It enables us as individuals and as a community to grow from our differences and to maintain our diversity without its becoming divisiveness. May we all be blessed by the vibrancy of our beloved community.